the promise of our Declaration of Independence, liberty and justice for all equally.
In order for each of us to protect our liberty, it's very important to be part of a strong community that protects all of us together from external dangers, but also then can protect each of us internally from being dominated by any of the others in our community. And to have that strong and healthy community that we might be part of, one needs healthy social bonds, and those social bonds need to be egalitarian.
That's Danielle Allen. On the brink of the midterm elections, we talk with her about the foundational ideas of our American Republic. Her book is Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in defense of equality. Then later, we talk with Katie Simpson Smith about her novel, The Story of Land and Sea. It takes place just after the Revolutionary War, when ideas of equality and liberty were transforming America. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. America, we've been told, was founded on the principle of liberty, a notion many like to claim as justification for doing whatever they want without restraint of law or regulation. Don't tread on me, the libertarians cry, as they oppose business regulations, push to carry guns openly, or claim their right to discriminate against fellow citizens. But in her close reading of the Declaration of Independence, my guest, political theorist Danielle Allen, says the core value of the founding document of our nation is equality, and it is the value from which liberty and justice derive. Her wonderful book, Our Declaration, examines what equality meant for the founders of our nation and what it means for us. The founders had many contradictions, not least of which was the fact that some of them espoused equality despite being slave owners. Allen doesn't shrink from those contradictions, but she shows that the founders transcended them by doing something we seem to have forgotten how to do. They brought together a diversity of views with a common purpose, to forge a community dedicated to the rights of all humans to seek happiness. What they meant was not private happiness per se, but happiness as a political right. Danielle Allen is a professor at Princeton's Institute of Advanced Study and the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. She's widely known for her work on justice and citizenship in both ancient Athens and modern America, and the author of several books. Our Declaration was published in June 2014 by W.W. Norton. Danielle Allen, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca. It's a pleasure to be with you.
This wonderful book, Our Declaration, it's a very close reading of the Declaration of Independence. The subtitle is The Reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality. Why does equality have to be defended?
The dominant ideal in our political discourse is liberty these days. And you can assess that by looking at how frequently concepts of liberty or freedom, in contrast to equality, are evoked in the speeches of presidential candidates and sitting presidents. And when you go through this, you'll find that there is much more frequent emphasis on freedom and liberty than equality. So I think we're more comfortable thinking about freedom. We know how to think about freedom. We understand that as a concept about our individual empowerment, our development as individuals of our own choices and personal capacities. We have ready ideas about possible restrictions to our freedoms or challenges to our freedoms, whether coming from government or sort of other forms of intervention. So I think we have well-honed ideas for thinking about freedom, and we have more confusion around the concept of equality. So, you know, there's the issue in the first instance that we know straight off that, you know, we're not all the same, so what can it possibly mean to say that in some sense we're all equal? And then if one identifies a core feature of humanness, of humanity that we share, our capacity to be political creatures, then there's a sort of subsequent question of, well, but what does that actually mean in practice? How does that idea of a core element of equality in human beings relate to how we think about politics or our social life and social policies or economics? And that's confusing. It's a complicated subject.
And would you talk a little bit then about what does equality actually mean? Because
a lot of people say, well, we're not all equal. And I don't want to live in a society in which we're all equal, in the sense of they seem to think it's like the notion of what communism is. We all have to share our resources equally. What does equality really mean?
Well, the Declaration of Independence makes a very profound case for political equality, and that's the kind of equality I focus on. And what political equality consists of is really sort of, there are two things. There's first of all a basic recognition that a defining feature of human beings is our capacity to be political. So human beings are, we do things in groups. We do things in groups through talk and conversation. That's something that's true sort of around the world. It's true across time. And our capacity to participate with others in conversation to make judgments about our current circumstances and what we should do about our current circumstances is all that is at the core of what being political is. So in the first instance, to say that we're all equal is to recognize that each of us has that capacity to participate in politics and to take ownership of our own lives, again, to judge our present circumstances and to choose a course for the future. So then there's a second question of, once one recognizes that we all have that core capacity, what kind of political system can best recognize that capacity? And there the answer is democracy. And then you have to start thinking about how, in the context of a democracy, one achieves genuinely egalitarian empowerment of a citizenry. So there are issues that come into play there about education. There's issues, of course, about voting rights and civil rights and how people have access to political institutions. There are issues of how we fund campaigns. You know, is it important to start thinking a little bit more about public funding of campaigns to open up the playing field for who can have the chance of running for office? So these are the kinds of things one needs to think about. And ultimately, if you ask somebody, do you want to be equal? The question that I have in mind there is, do you want to have an equal share of responsibility and opportunity to shape our shared political life? And that's what we're really talking about with the concept of political equality.
You know, this morning I was listening to a radio program that was exploring the issue of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has been actually writing laws in many states having to do with voting rights, climate change, all kinds of issues that bear on public needs, but take the point of view that you started out in the beginning, that this idea that liberty is more important than equality. You actually talk about the fact that there is no liberty without equality. Is that right?
That's right, exactly. So it's important to say, first of all, that this very commonly held idea that liberty and equality are in tension with each other, that's an idea that really dates to the middle of the 19th century, and it emerged with Marx and the responses to Marx. So Karl Marx and Communist Manifesto and other documents did make the case that in order to achieve sort of economic egalitarianism, one would have to violate property rights and things like that. And then the response to that was for, you know, generations of philosophers to start out by assuming an opposition between liberty and equality. In fact, for thousands of years before that, philosophers took liberty and equality to stand in harmony with each other, to be mutually reinforcing of each other. And this is the Republican tradition. It's the tradition from ancient Greece, from ancient Rome. And on this view, in order for each of us to protect our liberty, it's very important to be part of a strong community that protects all of us together from external dangers, but also then can protect each of us internally from being dominated by any of the others in our community. And to have that strong and healthy community that we might be part of, one needs healthy social bonds, and those social bonds need to be egalitarian. So that's the sense in which freedom depends on equality. We need equality amongst ourselves as citizens in order to form a social unit that has the capacity, the strength to protect us and protect our freedom.
So what I'm hearing you saying is that there is a connection between equality, liberty, and community.
That's right. Exactly. Yes. So equality is what helps us build community, and community is what helps us protect our liberty. That's the connection among these ideas. And it's, again, it's important when I talk about equality that what I am talking about there is first and foremost political equality. And that means the chance to participate in our public and shared decision making. I'm also talking about social equality in the sense that it matters that when we interact with each other on the street or in shops or in our churches or any of our organizations, that we have an egalitarian ethos. And I think, you know, we can be very proud of that in this country. If you look at our social organizations, it's amazing how many of them are run through committees and structures of committees. And that's a very egalitarian, democratic approach. And that's valuable. That helps us form our bonds of community. And then with regard to economic questions, it's not that we need, in fact, equality of economic outcomes. So that's not entailed by political and social equality. But we do need an economic system that's fair, that's recognized by everybody as fair, and that does do a reasonably good job of making sure that the sort of distribution of the goods that we produce isn't too skewed. So in other words, excessive inequality is a problem. But to say that excessive economic inequality is a problem is not to say that everything needs to be equalized.
So you take up this issue within the context, of course, of a close reading of the Declaration of Independence itself, but also the people who wrote it. And they were, you know, white men of property, of landed means. Several of them, most notably Thomas Jefferson, but others too, were slave owners, who yet, you say they, when they said all men are created equal, they meant all people. So could you talk about kind of the tension between these men as writers of a constitutional, of a document that speaks to all of us, as you say, not only in this country, but obviously has spoken to people throughout the world who have based their own constitutions on the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. Talk about that tension.
I think one of the most important things to remember about the Declaration of Independence, and this is true of the Constitution as well, is that there were many participants in those conversations and they did not all agree about everything. So there are many voices in the Declaration. It's not a single voice that we hear. So I like to call the Declaration a polyphonic text. So just to give you an example, the Committee of Five that drafted the Declaration consisted of four Northerners, none of whom were slaveholders, and one Southerner. Okay, so right there in the committee, you have an argument about the question of slavery. And so John Adams, for example, who was instrumental in moving the Declaration forward and in its drafting, didn't think slavery was a good thing. And the decision in the opening of the Declaration to talk about our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, leaving out the property concept, was a decision in the direction of those who were against slavery. So the Southerners had been using the property concept, the idea that one of the things they wanted to defend was their right to property, as a way of defending slavery. And Adams helped keep that concept out of the Declaration of Independence. So that's a place where we can see one of the participants who wasn't a slave owner doing important conceptual work to make sure that a truly egalitarian foundation was being built. So I think that's the most important thing to say, is that there's a diversity of opinions and views around the table, and there were people participating in Continental Congress who were already against slavery, working toward thinking about, you know, how to move beyond it and so forth.
And even Thomas Jefferson, am I right, he put in a clause that was then taken out that condemned slavery.
That's right. It's complicated. I mean, so Jefferson, you know, he gave us that incredibly grand opening that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And then in the list of grievances against King George, he had a long section where he criticizes King George for having protected the slave trade, for having started the slave trade and so forth. And he talks there about the king's violation of the sacred natural rights of men from Africa in bringing people into slavery. So he uses exactly the same vocabulary for talking about the rights of the enslaved Africans as he uses for talking about the colonists who were subjects of the British king. So he does draw an equivalence there. And so in that regard, even Jefferson seems to have genuinely meant that when he said all men are created equal, meant all people. But there's a twist, because he put that passage in there not simply or not straightforwardly as a sort of mere condemnation of the slave trade, but also, I mean, there's a sort of political purpose there, which is that the Southerners were interested in seeing the slave trade end because they had a market in their own slaves. So when there was no slave trade, their own slaves were going to be worth more, and they could profit by, in effect, breeding slaves and trading them. So it's a really double-edged element there that Jefferson's put in. But it was struck by the Continental Congress, and the reason it appears to have been struck is because that language about the sacred and natural rights of the enslaved was too polemical from the point of view of the slave faction.
So this kind of begs a question of the whole issue of private interest versus public interest, self-interest as opposed to community interest. I think also of things like the tragedy of the so-called tragedy of the commons. These are all constructions that oppose these two things. And yet, I feel that your book, Danielle Allen, this book, Our Declaration, is really arguing for a point of view that our self-interest lies in the community interest and vice versa.
That's right, exactly. I mean, if you dig into the concept of self-interest, and there's lots of sort of new work in economics even these days that makes this point, you'll find people's conception of their self-interest does usually include some notion of community, whether it's their immediate family or a larger network of their kin and relatives. So at the end of the day, self-interest is a social concept. And so the really important question is, what's the level at which one sees community as being valuable to oneself? And so my argument is that we should see the level of the whole democracy as being a level that we care about. So, you know, that a democracy should prosper is good for me. I prosper when my democracy prospers. So, yes, you're right that I am arguing for what I call an equitable concept of self-interest to distinguish it that from what I call a purely rivalrous concept of self-interest, where it's just me versus everybody else. So, yes, I think that properly understood, the concept of self-interest definitely includes a community concept.
So in a way, you could say that the social Darwinism of the 19th century ran counter to the intent and philosophy of the founders of our country.
Yes, yes. No, I would say that. So I think that the founders of our country were writing out of a Republican tradition that they themselves explicitly traced back to Rome, ancient Rome, and to some extent to ancient Greece. They tend to emphasize the Roman more than the Greek, but at any rate, and that tradition is absolutely one in which one recognizes the good of the society of which one's part as contributing to one's own good. So for one's own sake, one should care about the health of one's polity.
You taught this close reading of the Declaration of Independence to two very groups of students at one time. One was a very elite group of students from the University of Chicago, and other were folks who were poor from the African-American community that was around the University of Chicago. And you felt that the latter really were able to grasp these concepts that we've been talking about here in a more personal and intimate way than the other kids, and that was a very transformative experience for you. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure, and I'd be happy to. No, I had the great pleasure of teaching for 10 years in something called the Odyssey Project, which was a night course for adults roughly at the poverty line, focused on the humanities, giving them college-quality readings and discussion to help them get their foot back in the door in the educational system. And it was an extraordinary experience because we were taking the same sorts of texts that I was used to teaching at the University of Chicago core curriculum and teaching them in a very different context. And those night students were people who had come back to the classroom after, you know, a long time away from school or with having had difficult experiences with school in the past. And so they came in with nervousness. I mean, I think that was sort of, you know, the first session was always, you know, everybody was sort of on edge and can I really do this and why am I here and what's it really going to be like and that sort of thing. And then, I mean, quite quickly, there would just be a really strong relationship to the text and connection to the text, because at the end of the day, they were in those classes for sort of the purposes of their life. You know, they were in, their lives were not going the way they wanted. They were there to see what they could do to make their lives better. And so when they read anything, it was always with a view to understanding, how can I make my life better? And that's very different, I think, to undergraduates who've been fortunate to go through good schools and get into good colleges and universities, where they understand themselves instead really as sort of, you know, building a list of things they should have read, acquiring a body of information or knowledge that it was, you know, sort of good for them to have because, you know, check that off, I've gotten that out of the library. And so the former students really zeroed in on the places in the text where you could, you know, the author, him or herself, was engaged in a similar sort of probing of, you know, core meanings in life, core choices. How do I set a course for myself? And at the end of the day, the Declaration of Independence is really an exemplary text of that kind. I mean, and it sort of trumpets that in its very opening when it's, you know, win in the course of human events. And it's a very grand opening, but at the same time, it just comes down to the basic element of existence for each of us, that, you know, life is this fluid process, and from moment to moment, each of us is trying to understand our situation and make a judgment about it and make a decision about what to do about it. And so that's precisely what's happening in that text of the Declaration of Independence. And so for the students to realize that, you know, a text that, you know, they sort of didn't think of as belonging to them, it sort of felt like it came out of a completely different context, just is anchored to this most basic, most fundamental human experience, was exhilarating. And so there's just a lot of energy in the conversations around talking about the Declaration, and again, sort of working with it through that process of diagnosing one's own circumstances, making a judgment about them, and deciding what to do about them.
And why was that transformative for you?
It was transformative for me, I think, mainly because, you know, the Declaration is a text that, on the whole, gets dismissed in the scholarly context, partly because it's associated so closely with Jefferson, and then there's this issue of the hypocrisy of his being a slave owner. So the text is seen as sort of a propaganda piece that's supposed to help drive people to participate in the war, and it certainly had that purpose of stirring people up against the British and stirring them up to participate. So it's been a long time since I'd read it really from start to finish, and I had never really read it from start to finish with a view to thinking seriously about its philosophical argument. But when you're, you know, reading very slowly, sentence to sentence, with a group of deeply engaged students, you can't help but do that. And so the fact that it does convey a coherent philosophical view is what came through to me. And so I was, you know, sort of bowled over by the coherence of the view and by how powerful it is against the backdrop of our contemporary discourse, where, as I said, we tend to foreground liberty. And here is a text that had no embarrassment about proclaiming an ideal of equality front and center, and then not only proclaiming that ideal, but explaining just what it means. And, you know, in my book, I sort of bring out five different facets of the concept of equality that the Declaration argues for. And it's that sort of the relationship among those five facets that was so striking and powerful to me and just left me extremely impressed by the intellectual work that had been done by the group of people sitting around those tables.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Danielle Allen about her book, Our Declaration, A Reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality. So you mentioned five facets. Could you just run them by us so that we have a sense of the scope of what you're talking about?
So when we think about the Declaration and we think about equality, our minds go immediately to the second sentence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. But that's actually the second time the concept of equality comes into the text, and it's only, as I said, one of five moments where the idea of equality appears. So the idea of equality comes up in the first sentence when the colonists say that as a new nation, they're going to take their separate and equal station on the world stage. And there, that's a concept of claiming a right to self-government and a right not to be dominated by anybody else. So it's what I refer to as a non-domination ideal. And then we get the important second sentence, where what we hear is about the importance to each of us of participating in a government that's consent-based in order to secure our individual rights, such that then, you know, if the government's not working for us too, we have a right to change it or abolish it and build something new. So there, the concept of equality is about the equality of access to the tool of government that we all need. So it's an equality of opportunity, but it's specifically the opportunity to participate politically that's conveyed in that second sentence. And then the third way that equality comes into the text has to do with how the list of grievances is built. So there are these 18 complaints about King George, but it's not the case that they were simply generated by, you know, one or the other of the members of Continental Congress sitting in a room and just coming up with a list. Instead, as the Congress was moving towards independence, toward a declaration, they sought information from all over the colonies. So they put ads in all of the papers asking people to send in news and information about what the British had done to them. They wrote letters home to their constituencies asking for information, for stories, narratives about what the British had done. So this is an incredibly egalitarian approach to building knowledge and building communal understanding of our circumstances. So that's an important, what I call a sort of technical term, epistemic egalitarianism. So it's about knowledge and education that you approach in an egalitarian way to make sure that the community has the strongest possible body of knowledge resources flowing into its decision making. The fourth way that equality comes into the text is at the end of the list of grievances, when they sum them all up by basically saying that, you know, in every stage of these oppressions, they've petitioned to the king, and every point they've been met by further injury. So the king has not responded reasonably. And by complaining about the king's behavior in that way, they're basically complaining that the king has not accepted an ethics of reciprocity, where if you've done something unreasonable, you need to be responsive when people, you know, complain, point out the unreasonableness of what you've done, and you need to modify your behavior. And this notion of reciprocity, or sort of mutuality and being able to hold each other to account, is another core way in which an ideal of equality comes into the declaration. And then the final place it comes in is when, in the last section of the declaration, we see all the members of Congress pledging themselves and themselves on behalf of their states. They pledge their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor to one another. They mutually pledge, and you know, the word mutually there is important because it conveys that idea of equal sharing. We're doing this mutually, equally with one another. And that's where you really get that idea I was talking about equality being at the core of the bond that forms the community, which is what then protects all of us together. So that's a sort of equality of co-ownership of the political body. You know, each of us has an equal ownership share in the political body that we're forming together. So those are the five facets of equality that it would make to taken together for an incredibly rich account of political equality. It makes the point that it's not merely about voting rights. It's not merely about civil rights. We have to think also about how we generate the knowledge that feeds into our collective decision-making. We have to think about whether or not in our social relations with each other we have an adequate ethic of reciprocity operating, and so forth. I mean, so there's a lot in this argument about equality in the Declaration.
So what is the purpose of government then? Because that's really, in some ways, what these colonists are driving towards with these five principles of equality. What is government for?
Good. That's a terrific question. So, you know, the list of grievances is this sort of inside-out account of what government is for, right? Because it's a list of complaints about violations that the king has brought about, and therefore also about things that he should have done. And so, I mean, these things will be familiar. I mean, there is, in some sense, it's not rocket science. So it's rule of law, you know, fair access to justice in the case of issues of wrongdoing or disputes within the citizenry. It's a framework that permits the, you know, economic growth, prosperity, peace. It's another thing that government is for. Government should be helping to secure peace internally and externally. So one can go through that list of grievances, and that's what one gets, sort of rule of law, again, justice, fair access to justice, prosperity, peace. Those are the core features of good government in the Declaration.
So basically what they're saying is that we as human beings, that this is a self-evident truth that we have a right to happiness, to the pursuit of happiness. I think a lot of times people think that means, you know, maybe the pursuit of a rock concert or a drug or hanging out with your friends. But pursuit of happiness means something quite different.
Mm-hmm. So when they talked about happiness, they had an idea of the life well lived in mind. And so each of us has a responsibility for living our lives well, and that means making good choices in all the moments of choice that confront us. But they also recognize that in order to live well, in order to have the freedom, the scope to exercise our choice well, one needs to be working in the context of a political order that makes that possible. So, you know, when there are failures of the rule of law, when there are failures to provide access to justice, when there's an absence of security or absence of peace, then it's not really possible for people to function well with regard to making their own life choices. So that's the relationship between the, you know, political structure and our own individual responsibility for the life well lived.
So it's ironic. I mean, as you go through all of these, Danielle Allen, in both here and in your book, Our Declaration, you know, I just have to think how far we have fallen. We have some of the greatest inequality, probably the greatest inequality of any advanced country on earth. We have a new civil rights crisis in the unequal access, not even new, unequal access to justice and the criminal the so-called justice system. The list goes on and on. So now to the final point then, when governments fail to protect our rights, fail to guarantee our ability to pursue happiness, people have the right to revolt. Would you talk about that in the context of contemporary America?
Well, I agree with you that we're in a bad way at the moment, and I do think that it's a time where we should all be taking responsibility for the shape of our political life and working in the direction of the common good. And I think another important lesson from the Declaration of Independence is that it took them a long time before they got to the decision to revolt. So they tried a lot of things. You know, they made lots of petitions to the king. They made specific proposals about alternative institutional forms and that sort of thing. So, you know, in the key phrase, alter or abolish, I think one needs to put in the effort to alter and be able to show that one's consistently, over time, made an effort to change current circumstances before one's in a position to justify sort of revolt or abolishing a, you know, current set of institutions. And I think we have a long way to go in terms of engaging seriously around the question of altering our current circumstances. So at the most basic level, you know, we've got midterm elections coming up, and people should get out there and vote. You know, turnout in midterm elections is abysmal. And so that's one of the places where I feel like we need to put a lot of our own collective effort and energy is restoring our sense of obligation to participate even in those midterm elections, local elections, projects of local governance.
And beyond that, what other ways can people, other than reading this book, which I think, by the way, should be required reading in every high school, what are some of the other ways that we can take back for ourselves our declaration?
Well, I think, honestly, that one of the most important things that we could do is to recognize that equality and liberty are concepts that reinforce each other. They're mutually reinforcing. Equality is the basis out of which we build community that can help us protect our liberties. And to recognize this, it's an old idea, you know, it goes back millennia, it goes back to ancient Rome, goes back to ancient Greece. And it is the kind of idea that the founders were working with prior to the advent in the 19th century of Marxism. So it's only since the rise of Marxism and the period of Cold War that we've thought that liberty and equality stand in tension or opposition to each other. And I do think that that belief in an opposition between these two concepts is hindering our ability to see solutions. So I would really encourage everybody to spend some time reflecting on the ways in which equality and liberty mutually reinforce each other. And let's see if we can get back to that moment where these concepts were thought to be necessary for each other, and see if we can reconsider what our policy alternatives might be if we start seeing these two ideals as needing to work in tandem with each other.
And for one final point with that, EU government is really the arena on which that struggle is played out. I think we have such an anti-government sentiment in this country, which has in fact undermined the ability.
That's right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think, I'm sorry to interrupt you. But I would agree. I mean, I think that is another important thing we need to do is to recover our understanding of the value of government. And to say that government is valuable is not to say that big government is necessarily valuable. It's to leave open the question of exactly what the nature of government should be. But to recognize that government is a fundamental human instrument, a tool. We make it. It's ours. It belongs to us. But it's a tool that we should appreciate and understand what we can do with it in order to build healthy communities for ourselves. So trying to help people rebuild their understanding of the value of government, I think, is also a good thing to do.
Well, Danielle Allen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your terrific book, important book, is Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in defense of equality. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Francesca. Thank you for your engagement. I really appreciate it.
Danielle Allen. You can read an excerpt from Our Declaration by going to writersvoice.net. And by the way, we're excited to announce that Writer's Voice has a redesigned, more user-friendly website. It's built to work with all your web devices, smartphones, tablets, and good old computers. Check out the site, writersvoice.net. Join the email list and keep an eye on exclusive features we're rolling out in the coming weeks. And finally, let our website designer, Bill Way, know how much you appreciate the new site, or tell him what else you'd like to see there. We love his work. You can contact Bill directly at writersvoice.net. Next up, we go back in time to the waning years of the Revolutionary War with novelist Katie Simpson Smith. Stay tuned after the break.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before publishing her acclaimed debut novel, The Story of Land and Sea, Katie Simpson Smith was a historian. Her previous book was a study of motherhood in the American South from 1750 to 1835. The research for that book enabled her to get into the minds of the men and women who lived during that period, a time of great transition in America from subjugated colony to independent nation. The South and parts of the North were still in the grip of the slave system, of course, but even there the winds of liberty began to blow. In The Story of Land and Sea, Smith explores this transitional time through the lives of her vividly drawn characters. Set in a small coastal town in North Carolina during the waning years of the American Revolution, the novel follows three generations of family, fathers and daughters, mother and son, master and slave. The Story of Land and Sea is published by HarperCollins.
Katie Simpson Smith, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This novel, The Story of Land and Sea, takes place during the American Revolution. Tell us about the time that it's set in and the place.
So this novel is set at the very tail end of the Revolution, which is a very interesting time to me to put characters in, because it's sort of asking them to imagine a world that has not yet fully formed. America as a country is still very young and figuring itself out. And I think that reflects in the characters as well in terms of how they maneuver themselves through that very uncertain world. And the book is set in coastal North Carolina, which has a similar uncertainty to it. It's on the coast, but it's not easily accessed by ships because of the rocky coastline. And so you have these characters that are living their lives both on land and in sea, and in this sort of marshy territory in between.
And it's a kind of precarious life in some ways. Is that right?
It is, absolutely. Death is always on the horizon for people during this time period, and it certainly rears its head in this book as well.
It's a book that has some real tragedies at the center of it, and it concerns three intertwined families who share those tragedies. It begins with a father telling stories to his daughter about her mother. Tell us what's happening.
So the mother has died during childbirth, which means the daughter, Tabitha, never got a chance to know her. And as a result, she sort of builds the mother up into this figure that she wants to know better. So she's always pestering her father to hear stories about her. And the father, understandably, has difficulty sharing that part of his life with his daughter because his loss is still very raw. And when the daughter becomes sick, he has to decide what he will do to try to save her life and whether his actions will replicate some of the actions in his past.
What do you mean by replicate those actions in his past?
So when he first married the girl's mother, he took her to sea on a ship for about a year, and they had a wonderful time. It was sort of this blossoming of their romance at sea. And so he ends up taking his daughter to sea in an attempt to save her life, thinking that the ocean is the place where good things happen.
So one of the tragedies is that Tabitha, who's the young girl, her mother, Helen, died in childbirth, as you said, and then she also perishes from yellow fever. Talk a little bit about her father, how he responds to this, and then also about his father-in-law, Asa, because there's kind of a twin story of bereavement here and bereavement through the generations. And I wonder if you could trace that out for us.
One of the interesting things about these two characters is that they have both lost daughters that were extremely beloved. But because they're from two different generations, they react to those deaths in very different ways. Asa, the older of the two, finds comfort in religion and believes that if he just follows the rule of the Bible every day, that somehow God will forgive him and stop punishing him with the death of his loved ones. John, on the other hand, sort of fights against religion and sees God as a punisher and someone who takes away willfully people that he loves. So the two men's relationship with God is, I think, inherent to the story of their loss.
And we should say here that this is your first novel, but it's not your first book. You've written a historical book about motherhood during this very time, and we'll get back to that theme of motherhood later, but I just want to tell our listeners that you're a historian. And so I want to ask you here, is that shift in the way these two men deal with their bereavement, is that something that is true to the changing consciousness in America at that time? And if so, what was that change and how did that come about?
One of the interesting things about this time period is that there is a shift towards a more individualistic practice of religion. So you have the Great Awakening earlier in the 18th century that is very tuned into these ideas that are prevalent in America of, you know, every man for himself and an individual personal relationship with God. And I think that's what you're seeing with John more so than Asa, in the sense that God is not just an all-powerful being, but someone that you can actually talk to and reason with, even though he may not listen. And so there's so many changes, social and cultural and economic, during this period of the 1780s and 1790s. It's been fun to sort of put my characters in those difficult positions and see how they react.
Could you talk a little bit more about how, as a historian and a new fiction writer, you approached weaving these two stances together?
It's been very interesting moving from the role of historian to the role of novelist, because I've had to let go of a lot of my feelings about needing citations for everything and having to document everything. And as a result, it's been very freeing. I've been allowed to sort of go into the emotional minds of these characters and get into not only, you know, their day-to-day actions, but the motivations behind those actions. And, you know, while I can say that most of them are grounded in historical truth and that these actions may have been possible during this period, there's also the sense that, you know, I've made stuff up, and a lot of the characters' feelings about their loved ones, about loss, about love itself, one can never really know from just studying the historical record alone.
In your work as a historian, you must have read a lot of course, primary sources. Do you feel that you brought a 21st century consciousness to your characters, or did you really imbibe the 18th century consciousness in order to create the dialogue, in order to create the whole personalities that you were exploring in this book?
That's a great question. I tried to completely erase my 21st century consciousness. As you noted, I had to read, you know, hundreds of letters and diaries and plantation records for my dissertation. And having been steeped in that language of that time period, it really sort of, the rhythms of it got into my head. And so I felt as I was writing that I was doing them justice in terms of not only how they would have sounded, but how they might have felt. And part of erasing my 21st century mind is getting into the head of Asa, the grandfather here, who is a slave owner and who believes that slave owning is morally defensible. And of course, as a 21st century person, we would say that that would be hard to understand. And so trying to understand him and trying to create that figure to be sympathetic was one of my main challenges, but I felt that was the only way to do the time period justice.
And I just thought it was really marvelous the way you explore the theme of slavery. You have a very key character in this book, and I mentioned before three intertwined families. You know, we have Asa and his daughter, and then, of course, the family of his son-in-law and his daughter, Tabitha. And then you have the family of Mal and her husband, although when we first meet her, she's not married yet. Tell us about Mal. This is a time in the book where you actually go back in time to when Helen, Asa's daughter, is a young woman. And we explore this relationship between her and her slave, Mal. Talk about that relationship.
Yeah, so Helen is given Mal as a birthday gift for her 10th birthday. And that relationship alone is so defined by this idea of ownership and this idea that someone can be given to someone else. So as they grow older, they're the only two young women on the plantation, and they necessarily become quite close, are very sister-like in some ways, and yet the power dynamic always rears its head and never fully allows them to love and understand each other as one might hope. And so when Mal is a little bit older, she is given in marriage to another slave on a neighboring plantation, and she has no choice in the matter. And for Helen, this doesn't seem out of the ordinary because she's African-American. She's not white, and so Helen doesn't understand why such a person would even consider choice in marriage. So it's another one of those instances where these characters that we've grown to love have a reaction that is completely antithetical to everything that we think is good and proper. And so the two of them jostling for control in the relationship is sort of an interesting dynamic.
And Katie Simpson Smith, in this wonderful novel, The Story of Land and Sea, in exploring this relationship between the two of them, you have a situation you've just described where Mal is forced into a marriage and Helen bucks tradition in order to marry for love. Could you just delve a little bit deeper into the tension between those two different circumstances, those two different choices?
Yes, it speaks to the time period that women of all races had fairly little control over their own marriages. And we see one extreme in Mal, who is, as you say, forced to marry against her will. And then on the other hand, we have Helen, who her father tries to set up marriages for her with the eligible bachelors in town. But against all odds, she falls in love with a stranger and goes against her father's wishes and goes against her sort of familial duty in helping out with the plantation, to run away with this man in a time when that was seen as very shocking. And so both of their marriages also reflect on Asa, Helen's father, who is trying to dictate all of this and is having increasing trouble managing the women in his life.
And yet, as you said before, he's a sympathetic character, and I love the way he wrestles with the conflict between the dictates of society and the dictates of love.
I think he is the character that most sort of embodies the tension in this time period. So much of America is bound in tradition because of its tie to England, and yet it's trying to break free from that and create an identity that's very separate and that's very independent and very individualistic. And Asa is sort of sitting right in the middle of this and watching his daughter rebel against the system. And I think, you know, there are mirrors of him in all eras of society. These people that come from a conservative background and are faced with sort of increasingly liberal social beliefs. And he really does try his best to do what's right for his family and his daughter. But it's hard for him to reconcile that with what he thinks is morally and religiously his duty.
And I think it comes, this struggle comes very much to a head at the end of the book where Mal asks him to free her. Tell us about his initial reaction, and then as much as you feel free to do so without giving something away you don't want to give away, some of the evolution and thought that he goes through after that.
So when Mal asks for her freedom as a result of a chain of events that make her life increasingly unlivable, he rejects it on the premise that she should earn her freedom, that there's this belief in, you know, the self-made man. And if she wants her freedom, then he will allow her opportunities to earn money for herself. And eventually, after years and years of collecting, you know, nickels and dimes, she will eventually be able to earn her own freedom. And from Mal's perspective, this seems outrageous that no man or woman should have to earn her freedom. It should be a God-given right. And after their encounter, and Asa continues to think about what the difference is between theory and principle and an actual individual plea, I think he starts revising some of those ideas and comes to realize that Mal is not just a slave, but is a person who has been related to him and his family for the past 20 years or so.
We're speaking with author Katie Simpson-Smith about her debut novel, The Story of Land and Sea. She's also the author of a previous book, but this one, a historical book, We Have Raised All of You, Motherhood in the South, 1750 to 1835. I want to ask you about that other book because you get into the minds of each of these characters. So there's no one point of view. The point of view shifts between all of them. And in Mal's character, you take the opportunity to really explore the issue of motherhood and slavery. And I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that. What were the sources that you drew from for this picture? And tell us a little bit about the motherhood in the South during this period.
One of the things that jumped out at me most when working on the dissertation as it became the history book is that motherhood was never sort of a uniform proposition across the South, that women experienced it as they do today in so many different ways, and that it meant such different things to women depending on where they lived or their age or their religion or their, you know, state of freedom. And for Mal, who has these children with a man that she doesn't really love, and who sees that those children will be brought up in the same state of bondage that she is, motherhood means something very different than a sort of privileged white woman who has these children because she sees them as, or that she's trying to raise them to take on the family plantation one day. So for Mal, she has very conflicted feelings towards some of her children. Her first child is a son, and she sort of pours all of her maternal love into him because she can't help herself. And when she has children after him is when she starts realizing that they will become part of a system that has been so cruel to her. And it's painful to have to watch your children suffer in any way, you know, much less be enslaved. And so the reactions she has towards motherhood, I think, are a lot more complex than one might assume based on popular ideas about instinctive nurturing or instinctive love in a mother, which I found is really just not true at all.
Could you say more about that?
So we have this idea that when a woman has a child, there is this sort of natural love that comes from her towards her child. And if we look at motherhood historically, there's such a wide range of responses from mothers towards their children. Sometimes they're sources of love and joy. Other times they're economic burdens, or they come out of very terrible situations, either through rape or through slavery, and they become these symbols of a life that the mother would rather the child not have. And so for me, being able to write a character that has these complex emotions was a wonderful opportunity to show one aspect of that range of experiences of motherhood in this time period.
And yet Mal is not a typical slave, woman slave in the South of this time. She speaks in an educated manner. She's literate. Why did you choose to explore slavery through this character who herself embodied real contradictions, even of class and station within herself? Why did you choose to develop a character that embodied these kinds of contradictions?
For me, one of the most interesting things about fiction is going into the minds of people that you don't know much about or that you haven't heard much about. And so being able to explore this time period in this place allowed me to look at people whose lives are not always in the historical record. So Moll is not your typical slave in that she's on a very small plantation with very few slaves around her. And she is treated fairly well. You know, she's clothed and fed and taught to read and write, which is extremely rare for that time period. And yet I wanted to show how even under these quote-unquote ideal conditions of slavery, it can be so galling to the soul to be trapped in that way. And so when she attempts to break free of it, it shows sort of one facet of all the slaves that were yearning to break free during that time period.
Now, the novel, The Story of Land and Sea, ends in a very indeterminate manner. We won't reveal how it ends, but I know I really wanted to know what happened next. Why did you leave the reader hanging like that?
That's a good question. For me, the book sort of came to a natural end there, and I like the way that it allows readers to imagine various alternative endings for themselves. It sort of puts the reader in the position of author and says, okay, I've left you with these characters in this situation. What do you want to happen next?
I guess that's a good answer, and that gives me permission to decide exactly how I do want it to end. Now, this novel was acquired in a 10-house, 7-bidder auction. How did you manage to, fall? Was it incredible luck or something else that put you in that position as a debut novelist?
It was definitely luck. I had a wonderful, wonderful agent who believed very strongly in me and my book, and he sort of sold it with a passion that I am eternally grateful for. But I know that this happens very rarely to debut authors, and so I'm just so grateful to be published at all and to have attention being directed towards the book. Just makes me feel so happy and excited for my characters.
That's great. Well, I'm happy and excited for you because this is a wonderful novel, The Story of Land and Sea. Katie Simpson-Smith, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and I look forward to more fiction from you. Are you planning another book?
I am. I'm working on my second novel right now.
And is it also a historical novel?
It is also historical and set in the South.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to talking with you about that when it comes out.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, same here. Thanks so much.
Katie Simpson-Smith. You can read an excerpt from The Story of Land and Sea by, you guessed it, going to writersvoice.net. And while you're there, check out my fascinating web-only interview with Katrina Vandenheuvel of The Nation magazine about her in-depth conversation with NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. The Snowden interview is featured in this week's edition of The Nation. Vandenheuvel tells us all about it. Check it out. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.